This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 283.ZP0206, certificate number 45989, Cottage Core.
We're in the depth of a pandemic that's got us all confined and quarantined to our homes. Maybe even when this show airs after the election, there will be a different feeling about where we are. And I think even now, you and I being members of the ivory tower liberal elite of the Northwest, we probably think of the quarantine differently than people who are attending the Republican National Convention.
I've noticed in particular, I have a lot of privilege in my pandemic surroundings. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone,
right?
Which is nice.
But nor are you cooped up with a bunch of people you don't like.
Right. I have three family members, all of whom I love, living with me.
But not in the same room.
Exactly. Plenty of places for everybody to get away from each other. And, you know, we have windows.
Right.
Did I tell you this? A couple months ago, we had our house painted and all the windows were covered for 2 days. And I was like, oh, this is why people trapped in apartments are losing their mind.
Yeah, you need windows.
It can be a little claustrophobic.
But we're taking the pandemic seriously still. We're still quarantined, both of our families. Although, because you and I meet in this bunker to record our show, we're quarantined together. So we have
that. That's true. We're a little pod.
We have that option. And just the other day, this past weekend, we invited you out to have a campfire dinner with us.
Yes. You guys have access to a little community beach here that we had to show ID to get in. We had to pretend to be your friends or something.
Yeah, you had to pretend to be our friends. And we lit a fire in a little campfire circle, and we roasted wieners.
My kids were very opposed to the terminology.
Yeah, Dylan and Caitlin both hate the word wiener.
They were unified in not wanting to attend a weenie roast.
But they wanted to, what do they call them?
They don't say franks. They don't say weenies or wieners.
They say hot dogs. Is that it?
They say hot dogs.
But it's a weenie roast. It's like right in the name, weenie roast.
I don't think anyone of their generation ever said weenie roast. And I don't remember people like weenie roast. To me, sounds very much like a
Cub Scout in the 50s?
Yes.
Yeah, we said weenie roast. I don't know why.
Did you call them weenies? Were you like, hey, you want me to heat you up a couple of weenies?
I believe so.
Do you want me to heat up your wiener for you?
I do believe we did, although, you know, we also said hot dogs.
I think wiener almost exclusively meant penis when I was in elementary school.
I think so. I think it did. But I think,
you know, is that part of the fun?
I had older people around me. My parents and relatives were all a little bit older, so I think they might have called them wieners.
I'm trying to remember if, like, even my grandparents ever offered me, like, beans and weenies.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Franks and beans is what they called them.
Yeah, Franks. And we don't say Franks either. What happened to Franks?
Well, I don't call them Franks because I'm, you know, because the Hun is coming over the parapet.
Is that when we got rid of wiener in Frankfurt? Did we develop hot dog as a way of making garbage food seem more patriotic during World War One?
But we ate a bunch of garbage food together around the campfire.
It was lovely.
And yet there
the sun sank into Puget Sound.
Kind of wholesomeness to it, right? We didn't, it's not like we were spraying each other with Mountain Dew. We tried to. But we were using conventional ingredients. We were making s'mores out of Hershey's chocolate. We were, you know, we ate some watermelon.
Some Fritos and watermelon. And it really could have been almost the same menu in 1940.
But and neither of us, at least in that instance, felt beholden or encumbered by the... whole food or natural food, raw food movements that we, back in the old days when we went to fancy restaurants, you know, we could be forgiven for checking the menu to see if there were, if it was all natural beef. I mean, we're middle-class people. We're sort of indoctrinated in that culture of natural foods, expensive and artisanal or artisanal foods.
But there was something about just being around a campfire that made you just not care so much, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You didn't want fancy sausages that tasted like apple and jalapeno.
Not if you're roasting them on a little sharpened stick.
I mean, and you're going to end up smelling and tasting like campfire anyway. I found the next day that the car still smelled like campfire just from having meat in it.
That's how it goes, right? And we didn't make s'mores with salted chocolate, you know, 70% cacao.
Can you imagine a time when desserts did not have salt sprinkled on them? So weird.
Yeah. No, I'm fine with that. I don't want salt on my desserts.
It's something that, I guess I think of that as restaurant culture, but it hasn't really bled over into my daily life that much. I mean, I guess ingredient-wise, like, I never ate fennel as a kid, and now I'll have fennel in a salad even at home. And I don't think, ooh, la-di-da, a fennel. So I guess it has changed me a little bit, food culture.
But part of it is, part of it is just that was the fashion in the restaurants in Seattle. That was the style. And you wanted to, I mean, you had to eat out, and people would invite you to go places. And the idea that it was a special event, that you were that the waiter would come explain your food to you, and the explanation wasn't just this is a hen cooked in butter, but that this was a hen named Elizabeth and cooked in butter that she lived next to.
There's a Seattle restaurant that will remain unnamed, but that I never went back to, just because, I mean, two criminal offenses. First, it had nothing but a communal table.
Yeah, that's hard.
I don't want to eat next
to a stranger. That's the way of that style. Yeah. And they said the butter was named Elizabeth.
And I know it means I'm a bad person for not wanting to
pass a bowl of rutabagas around with strangers.
To random people.
Yeah.
Because I know it takes a village. And the second thing is they would serve the food, but if you tried to, and then immediately eat, you would look like the godless kid digging in before the nun says the prayer in the movie or something.
Yeah.
Because you had to wait for the chef to come out and just tell you all about the source for the fiddlehead ferns where you were about to eat and what farm the persimmons came from.
Right.
And I didn't care
it's
about any of that.
Very performative.
And it seemed like a bit of a personality cult. Like I was really supposed to enjoy the fact that this guy was deigning to come down and tell me about his persimmons. And these I didn't care. Go back to the kitchen.
These are the people that refer to chefs as chef.
In this case, it was chef first name.
Oh, and Chef Bob. I can see that.
I don't want to say the name because maybe this will let people identify the restaurant. But my wife and I were just rolling our eyes every time Chef First Name came out to, okay, everyone, don't eat yet. Chef First Name is about to come out and walk us through where these dates came from.
Tell you about the salt that's named Elizabeth.
Mm. Why is it always Elizabeth for you?
Well, it's an old fashioned name. And I think if you're going to name a chicken or a piece of butter, you're not going to name it like Brianna. You're probably going to name it Elizabeth or Marjorie.
One thing I learned at the campfire, I think, is that your sister is pretty much vegetarian, But she will eat a chicken if she knows its name
or
something?
Yeah, she's a fake vegetarian, but she doesn't, she only eats things. I mean, yeah, this is kind of the, this is in a way part of the style that I'm describing, which is that somehow eating a chicken that was raised with a, wearing a bow in its chicken hair is somehow more okay to eat. A chicken that has had dreams revealed, a chicken that has...
A chicken that lived a full life.
Yeah.
Is a that chicken what we're
that,
saying?
A chicken that stood on top of a hill and looked out at the horizon and thought, one day I will, you know, I'll set to sail, and then was killed, you know, because you don't want a chicken that's 5 years old. That chicken would be terrible.
Are you saying that's worse if that chicken had hopes and dreams and then it met the axe?
No, I think a chicken raised in a slave cage is going to have a worse time. I do think that...
Right.
I mean, that's
the thing is...
A chicken wearing a bow is better off.
At least by omission, it's not in some awful poultry factory.
And we've talked before, and I think we're all conscious of the fact that industrial production of animals in particular, but also all the antibiotics and other chemicals that go into keeping those industrially caged animals from dying of infections, makes the food maybe questionable. We were talking both as fathers of daughters, just being conscious of the fact that there's so many hormones in food, and that actually affects the growth and development of our children, or at least is connected to accelerated puberty.
I think one of the things that has dropped the puberty age in America by a matter of years, I think, since we were kids, has been hormones in milk.
Hormones in milk, and also hormones in the chemicals that make up plastic bottles, or mm-hmm. chemicals that imitate hormones in the body. But there's something more to this whole question, and it's something that's that in a way is kind of age old. It's been reoccurring now for centuries. The idea that we are divorced from nature, that we are divorced from our essential selves. There have been several omnibus entries, second sleep, for instance, an idea that our natural way of living in a pre-industrial society would involve waking up in the middle of the night and gossiping and making another meal, maybe reading the Bible, whatever it is, dancing by moonlight, casting spells, eating cats, whatever people did before second sleep. But, you know, and it dates back to a kind of, I think what you would say was enlightenment ideas that the newly encountered Native Americans were more natural and more elevated by virtue of the fact that they weren't encumbered by all of modernity and all of this, you know, war-making equipment and natural, or I'm sorry, and sort of unnatural philosophy even.
Is that the first time we'd ever, most Europeans had thought about the contrast, I guess?
I think so, because encounters with pre-industrial people prior to that were just opportunities to enslave. And it was, and including early contact with Native Americans, it was only after the Enlightenment, during a period where, you know, an examination of consciousness and will, and all of a sudden there, not all of a sudden, but you could look across the sea and find examples of people unpolluted who were living closer to the land, closer to a kind of relationship, not to animal husbandry as much as to animals in their natural state.
And the funny thing is, a lot of this is happening before the Industrial Revolution really redraws cities. I mean, these aren't people in smoky, choked, cramped cities who are dreaming of the noble savages in their forests. It's just people on farms who are like, well, it's got to be a better way.
People in salons mostly. Yeah. And what they were lamenting was the political culture, the all the alliances and wars within Europe, all of the, and in some ways they're all recent. I mean, the plagues are all in recent memory. But it's also a reevaluation of religion and a post-Protestant mm-hmm. idea that a natural connection, a personal connection to God, is kind of a deindustrialization of religion.
Yeah, it's not related to the state religion. It should be unmediated by the king and his church.
And as you get further away into deism, you see that, it's possible, rather than trying to import religion to the Native Americans or to uncontacted people, maybe what we should be doing is understanding their connection to God. And all of that is, it's feeding a kind of philosophical movement. But it wasn't until the kind of really early days of the Industrial Revolution that there was an organized response to industrialization that built upon these Enlightenment ideas and started to really advance the notion that industrialization and modern civilization was divorcing us from truth and enslaving us in an artless and inauthentic existence.
Most of those people kind of pontificating in their London coffee houses or whatever maybe would not have, maybe you need to not have firsthand appreciation of the actual countryside, because then you would think of it as kind of a dirty, sweaty, difficult life, right? Like you have to have only seen it in paintings or read about it in pastoral poetry.
What we think of as the natural English countryside or French countryside are really manufactured products of hundreds of years of cultivation of the land, often for vistas, mm-hmm. on those giant estates. Marie Antoinette famously had a small village constructed at Versailles.
That she wanted something quaint, right?
Yeah, that she actually populated with artisans and people masquerading as peasants.
I bet that would be a good gig, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like if your choice is to be a real peasant or to go eat palace food and dress as a peasant, it's kind of like being in, being in Main Street on Disneyland, pretending to work in a turn of the century magic shop.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Marie Antoinette would take her favorite people out to her little Potemkin village and spend all day pretending to be peasants. And the little peasants that she had employed to do peasant things, I mean, they all had a merry time.
It's funny to think about how much Marie Antoinette would just love Disneyland.
Well, yeah. Well, think about Versailles.
Or Colonial Williamsburg.
It is freaking Disneyland. But that became a fashion among the aristocracy to have little follies on their property that mimicked an old ruin or a little thatched roof.
You're talking about
village.
Romanticism.
Well, it's prior to Romanticism. Romanticism kind of was the next extension of this, the maybe more widely popular version of it, more widely accessible. Not everyone can build a tiny village and inhabit it with peasants.
I certainly can't, and I've done very well for myself.
Me either.
Is that your dream, though? Would you like to?
Oh,
is that why you're clearing all that brush in your backyard?
I just dress up my cats and make them, act out little plays for me.
My children are now too old for me to try to
get them to dress.
Put them in a little village.
My daughter just read Little House on the Prairie and immediately took an interest in little chintz dresses. Little.
It seemed like she was wearing something kind of gingham-y when she opened the door today.
Yeah, she's very into dressing like someone on the prairie and acting out little wagon train scenes and stuff. And it's all in contrast to her otherwise 100% Star Wars based play space.
I said, "Who is this American Girl doll?" Yeah. And she said, "I'm not an American Girl doll," which fair enough.
Yeah.
She's not.
She kicked you in the shin then, right?
Yeah.
And then hit you with her lightsaber. But she does spend some time out on the picnic table now. Every once in a while I see her like crack a little switch and go, "Yeah, yeah." And she's talking to some potted plants.
American Pioneer Fiction is such a, it's crazy how little American girls of any era seem to take to it. And I'm not sure is it just because of the success of that foundational text, those Laura Ingalls Wilder books, or is there something inherent about the planes that speaks to them?
Well, I think that, and I, we may make a connection at the end of this episode to that. The appeal of this pastoralism, is always an appeal to simplicity. and an appeal to authenticity.
Maybe simplicity more for little kids. Those kids never, I remember as a kid reading those and being like, they don't go to school.
Right, right. They, or
I don't have to do my math workbooks if I'm living in the Minnesota woods.
And she and I just read a couple of stories where Where the Red Fern Grows, where, you know, going to town is something that you put your little bare feet to the trail and walk all day, sleep outside, and then you get to town the next day.
Those books are very sensual.
Yeah, they are.
Pages and pages of description of food that you're salting away for winter. The games the kids play, just maybe because they're more about the patterns and textures of everyday life than most things you read at that age. That was very formative for me.
Well, and also your anxieties are not so disassociated, right? Your anxieties are wild animals. And most of those kids are portrayed as pretty resilient, pretty unafraid.
They get scarlet fever and they're fine.
Yeah, they spend the night outside and they never panic. When they get lost, they don't freak out. They find their way home.
They have very comforting parents in those books.
Yeah, that's right.
So you feel very protected. There's a cozy aesthetic to those books, even though they're on the edge of a dangerous frontier and there's bears and Indians and panthers.
Mom and dad are both very hardy. There's almost no problem that one or the other of them can't fix. Mm-hmm. Mom can feed the family based on nothing. Dad can fix any wagon. And sure, there aren't complications. There's never a question of whether mom is going to come home from work late. You don't have to worry about what's on the radio.
It seems like you're saying that they're comforting because the fears in them are bigger.
The fears are bigger, but they're knowable, right? There's not an existential fear.
And do you really think that's true? I always assumed people back then had all the existential fears and anxieties, plus a panther might eat you.
Yeah, and I think that might be a modern overlay.
Yeah.
And part of it is if you're working all day,
you don't have time for. Yeah,
if you wake up and just basic survival requires that you work until the sun goes down.
I can see that.
What time do you have to sit around and wonder about what the meaning of it is?
Or what, what Nellie Olson thinks about you.
Right.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe those are modern luxuries.
And we can draw a lot of, a lot of this finds its lodestone, its birthplace in Walden.
Mm.
Thoreau leaves behind the hustle bustle of what was probably Boston with a population of 75,000 people, and departs to Walden, which actually wasn't that far away from anything.
Yeah, I think he's actually going from Concord, which is probably a small, quaint town today, the kind of thing we would yearn to.
I mean, you've been to Concord, right? I mean,
there's nothing there.
There's no point at which Concord was a metropolis.
No.
And Walden isn't that far, right? When you read the book, you think, wow, he's out in Walden.
Basically, he's glamping on some friend's big backyard.
But his premise was he's going to return to nature and in doing so, be free of the encumbrances. And that book was extremely popular and remains popular and was jump-started the whole.
That shows that as early as 1840, whenever right. That book came out, people were kind of feeling like there were anxieties in modernity that in simpler country times you didn't have to deal with.
And the Industrial Revolution was in full swing at that point.
Yeah.
But still a fairly new phenomenon. I think you could say that it started in the late 1700s, American Revolution era, when things started to be manufactured by machines, and by 1840 was in full swing. We were now, craftsmen who were part of the process of making things from the design stage to the finished product. By which, if you were an axe maker, you drew the axe.
I start with a tree and I make an axe.
Yeah. And you end with an axe. All those processes had been divided, and division of labor was one of the main constituent parts of into the Industrial
Revolution. It's more efficient to stand in one place and put one bolt in an axe handle.
That's right. You sit and do this, and I'll sit and do that, and together we'll make an axe. And that that divorce from craftsmanship and from a connection to making things was, even in its time, seen as seen by thinkers and by theorists as a kind of death of nature and a death of our natures, and a quarantine from something intrinsic to health and to mental health.
It's an easy sell. Like, I don't think I'm alone in the fact that, like, just walking through a totally unremarkable forest, I feel, you know, pleased and rejuvenated in a way that I do not feel on a city street.
And the to imagine that even as the Industrial Revolution was just ramping up, we were only at the very dawn of experiencing machine-made products and assembly line-made products.
98% of the things that scramble our brains today did not exist.
There was already a widespread movement to condemn this the mass production.
Maybe back then it was just typical kind of old person carping. Maybe it was just, you know, in living memory, there were old people still being like, in my day.
Well, no, it was very popular with young artists, because of the feeling of alienation and the feeling that, wait a minute, these are, like so often happens with technology, you see the world changing as a result of the technology without there being any underpinning theory. No one has worked out, is this good for us? We're seeing it now with social media, and we're acting as though it's never happened before. But social media came in and we all went, oh, interesting. And before we had time to think about it, it ruined our lives. And now we're trying to reevaluate it and think about, like, are there theories behind this?
Even Mark Zuckerberg and his dorm room friends weren't like, you know, sitting around on their beanbag chairs being like, how do we change the world for the better? Which is how you like to think about new innovations. They were just horny for the girls in their dorm.
Yeah. And then when they realized it was a thing that was popular, they thought, how do we make money from this?
Right.
And that's true of a lot of these innovations. And I talk about it in relation to the mechanization of war quite a bit, or the robotization of war. It began with drones and now is increasingly, I mean, everything's becoming drone war.
I was watching Failsafe. You guys on Failsafe on Friend of the Fair yet?
Yeah.
The original one, the Henry Fonda one.
Yeah.
And, you know, it hasn't
appeared yet, but yeah, it's on the list.
In that movie, which is kind of about the nuclear fears, you know, it's all about how the machines are going to be to blame because they're now acting too fast for sensible humans to impose any kind of morality or even common sense on the decisions. And the pilots are all grumbling about how someday they're going to have planes that pilots don't even fly.
And it seemed crazy talk.
It seemed crazy talk in 1964 when that movie came out. And it kind of seemed crazy talk in 2004.
Right.
But in the last 15 years, those pilots from the 60s are absolutely right. Like, that was the goal, to advance things so far that you do not need human oversight at all.
Well, and the argument in favor of it is sort of undeniable because we don't put our pilots at risk anymore. Our soldiers, we're going to have much higher survivability.
And it's the same in industrialization. I mean, really, it's the capitalists wanting to, you know,
streamline,
to pad the bottom line. But right. The idea is, you know, fewer unpleasant tasks. We've got machines now to hammer that metal in, and you don't have to do it with a hammer anymore. Isn't that nice?
And in a way, you're talking to an audience of people that work from dawn to dusk and scrape a living off the land. And the initial appeal of, like, come to work in a factory, we'll pay you actual money, and you can have, well, not weekends off, not for a while, not until the labor movement, but at least at the end of the day you go home. And
the more mechanized the job, the less sweaty your labor.
Right. And you buy things with money instead of make things with your
trading hands. Things for eggs.
I mean, and you can move to the city, and you will have access to the city. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that people did not march into industrialization at the end of a bayonet point so much as it seemed like the advantages were apparent. And it's only later that you feel that estrangement. We've noticed with drone warfare that the difference is now we can kill people kind of with impunity, and that the decision-making process for that now is also starting to be automated. And if you don't have people who are actually at risk, what keeps you from being in a state of total war all the time? We could just be at war with everybody, and people here at home feel no, you know, fewer and fewer of our soldiers die. And so what are the stakes for us?
It's the Twilight Zone where if you press a button, somewhere on the other side of the world dies.
Right.
So why not?
So why not?
I'm never going to see them.
With industrialization, it was in the mid-1860s, the middle part of that century, that that there started to be kind of an organized movement. A man by the name of John Ruskin saw industrialization as being a problem of moral and social health. He recognized that, and this is at a time when people still had 8 kids and all lived in a giant house together, but he saw communities starting to become dissolute. People were losing connection to one another. People were moving to unhealthy cities, leaving the land behind. And he had, you know, all of these anti-industrial philosophies also have a very strong aesthetic component.
It's funny that John Ruskin yearned for a natural landscape. Do you know the famous story about his marriage?
No.
This may or may not be true, but in one popular retelling, he never recovered from the shock on his wedding night when he learned about pubic hair on women.
He didn't know it was there?
Paintings had not informed him.
Interesting. And that from then on, he could not perform?
Yeah, and that essentially ended his marriage. So it's ironic that he yearned for a natural landscape and other... Also, that story may not be true, but it's a common
You know, he probably legend. Was influenced by the pre-Raphaelite paintings, which also kind of depicted this
idealized...
Sort of land of nymphs and fauns that all had curly black hair and sizable noses.
They're cavorting.
There's a lot of lily pads in those paintings.
Is that really? Are lily pads sexualized in some way?
Oh yeah, you're gonna.
I'm not into lily pad core, but
you're gonna see that lily pad action. But the complaints about what industrialization produced was that the products were kind of ignorant of their constituent parts. If you were making a thing out of wood and this tree and that tree, they became equal and undistinguishable. Although throughout history, the wood from this tree and the wood from that tree were very different, and a craftsman would approach making things out of that wood very differently. And in an industrialized process, when you run out of alder, I guess you switch to birch. And someone that works with wood would say, that's not, you can't do the same thing. You know, it's too different. So that ignorance.
You're actually losing artistic skill.
And losing a connection to the material, the natural material of the world. What you produce is vulgar. It's base. It's less useful.
And I totally believe this.
Sure.
You just go to the toy aisle of a dollar store and it's
awful.
It's not beautiful.
And so the reaction, the industrial reaction to that is to make those things more appealing to consumers by making them excessive and ornate, falsely ornate. Mm. You add gewgaws, you add paint,
bright colors.
Yeah, and that ornateness isn't native. It's not an ornate. It's not a functional ornateness. And so that artificiality then means that things become impractical, and you're preferencing novelty, which is kind of dishonest and soulless, and the work is repetitive, and the products are repetitive,
and probably less. There's less product quality in the product, so they don't last as long. They don't do their thing as well.
Anything made by machines, you find that as the machines, you know, as the tooling wears down, things that are made later. I mean, there's a sweet spot where the tooling is worn enough that things have smooth edges and they function, you know, without hiccup. But then as things start to, as tooling starts to wear, there's within industrial process, there's a kind of an acknowledgement like these tools are worn, but they still work and we're going to keep milking them in until they break before we replace them. And, you know, products made with those worn out tools are...
But you can sell them for the same price.
You sell them for the same price. And to a consumer, they sit on the shelf the same way. Mm-hmm. The preference then, as advanced by John Ruskin, and then ultimately by what became known as the arts and crafts movement, was for things that were made by human beings, that were involved in the whole sort of design through creation, handicraft, no division of labor, raw and unprocessed materials.
Is this the beginning of the, do you get into the English arts and crafts movement here?
You do. And William Morris then took these and again, connected a real aesthetic to it, but it was an aesthetic that made claim to a moral, a social and moral improvement.
This wallpaper produces good-hearted children.
It does, right? That not just making things, but being surrounded by made things, is good for the soul. This is the premise. The arts and crafts movement went across a lot of genre of architecture and of, but also not just decorative arts, but practical arts. If you think about the Olmsteads and the many, many parks they designed around the United States, all part of this kind of return to a natural aesthetic, return to a time when things were made with intention.
It goes into education too. Waldorf schools really, really value and center, you know, students touching natural
right.
fibers and textiles and wood. And we used to make fun of that when our friends would send their kids to Waldorf schools. Oh, hope they get to touch a lot of natural woods today. That polyester, that's soul sucking.
Well, and you wonder how much, I mean, there's a huge difference between living in the woods and living in a city and touching wood as part of your, part of your schooling. I mean, you know, you can touch wood all day, but does it really connect you to nature? And this is the kind of question of arts and crafts. Does it become not just decorative, but does it become, exclusive? Where
these become for an elite class,
yeah,
who knows the difference and can afford the difference.
You like these things and you're smart, and also your kids get to go to Waldorf schools. And it's not a movement to make all schools Waldorf. It's not a movement to let all kids touch wood. It's your kids that are touching wood.
And I guess in the early days of this, I mean, today it's a commonplace middle-class thing that you can get out of the city and, you know, instead of, if you yearn for the natural world, you go camping for the weekend.
Yeah.
And that's something that's become possible in the American century with the automobile. You know, that would have been a lot, that's a bigger project for a non-elite person in 19th century Europe or America. It involves train tickets.
Well, that's the thing. It was an argument for trolleys, mass transit. You know, all those interurban trains were meant to take you out to...
For a weekend, yeah. You know, a picnic or something.
Out of Concord, out to Walden. But also Central Park was built with the justification that it would give New Yorkers exposure to the outside.
You know, those big dramatic kind of boulders and rock cliffs you see in Central Park, it really is kind of an effort to bring some, dramatic, romantic landscape into the city. It's not supposed to just look like the countryside. It's supposed to look like an illustration of the countryside.
Yeah, and even now in a city of 9+ million people, when you go into Central Park, you can find yourself in a kind of what feels like, I mean, except for all those freaking fences that they put up every time, you know, they want to protect some grass, but you can get out there and get lost and find yourself in a wooded copse. You know,
that has a real fairy tale vibe,
but it's social engineering. You know, it's an attempt to make life in a complex urban environment seem manageable and
it's a 19th century holodeck.
Yeah, that's right. And then you can go back to your tenement.
To your factory job, yeah.
And feel like, well, I got, you know, I got that fresh air. It's like, oh, there's coal-burning furnaces all around you. The air wasn't that fresh. But, you know, and that romanticism, I think, after World War One, there entered in a lot of cynicism. And it was and this spread worldwide. I mean, we think of the Japanese, like their respect for traditional craftsmanship and the, you know, their ancient crafts as being something that's been part of Japanese culture in a continuum, but it really is a product of a revival in the 1920s.
Oh, interesting.
Called the Mingei, where there was within young Japanese artists and thinkers, suddenly
the old crafts are getting lost.
Yeah. All these old guys that are making soy sauce with a paddle. All of a sudden, there were these young guys in high collars and tight neckties going, you know, this is amazing. Like, we need to give you a gold medal, and I'm willing to pay extra for this, mm-hmm. you know? And that's what it really comes down to a lot of the time.
I mean, anything scarce will become a luxury good.
Right. Arts and crafts sort of evolved through Art Nouveau, which became... still had the trappings of a philosophy, but became much more just decorative art.
Nature has pretty shapes. Yeah. Let's use those.
But then the reaction to Art Nouveau was deco. And deco got real stainless steel and you know, deco and Bauhaus.
Keep the curves, but make them kind of mathematical.
And industrial.
Yeah.
And to turn the, you know, when I think artists and theorists realized that there was no longer any fighting industrial production... to then make those processes aesthetic and to build the Center Pompidou where all the ducting is painted bright colors and to, you know, to embrace industrialization and find beauty and meaning in it. And so throughout the 20th century, and then following upon deco was modernism. Modernism, again, mid-century modernism did try and integrate the outside and the natural world with the forms, but the forms were all very rectilinear and the inside-outside connection was done through plate glass windows and cement patios.
I was about to say, if you can't afford an all glass house in the woods, upstate New York, then you're kind of out of luck.
Well, and mid-century modern architecture was the architecture of the post-war boom generation, and they made a million of those little houses, all of which sort of tried to get that patio inside-outside thing, a big green lawn. But it was a very different idea of what an interaction with nature was, that you would have your own fenced-off garden.
It's an extremely manicured nature. Right. It's very... it's very uniform. Mm-hmm. You want your yard to look like your neighbor's, not to have any particular drama or romance to it.
Right. And you feel like there are just fewer surfaces to dust. I mean, one of the appeals of mid-century modernism was all those Art Nouveau lamps just took all day to clean. And, you know, with this, you could just have a robot. But throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were many movements of a kind of return to nature. There was in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, this sort of this sense of returning to a commune, a back to nature movement where people were going out to farms and trying to create collective sort of economies where barter economies and lots of animal husbandry. That was very popular in the 1970s, also connected to a kind of back to Jesus movement that, at least in our contemporary times, it seemed like from a 1970s perspective, going back to a 19th century version of Protestantism or an 18th century one felt like really going back.
This time with acoustic guitars.
Right. Take it all the way back. That again fell out of fashion in the 1980s and kind of throughout the 1990s. It just wasn't what people were talking about in the West.
That's a forward thinking time. It's sort of the beginning of the information economy.
Yeah. And we're again, thinking in terms of science fiction, thinking in terms of, once personal computers arrive on the scene, it's very hard to say, no, the future is out here in Central Oregon, and where Wavy Gravy and I are making our own cheese.
And maybe even the primitiveness of those computers convinces you that more steps are coming.
Yeah.
Like, maybe in some level, and I don't remember if I felt this at the time, just having an Apple II personal computer in your house makes you feel like this is just the start of something.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah, this is not the pinnacle of this.
My robot butler is coming.
It's getting better now every 6 months.
Well, what we've seen in the last really 5 or 6 years has been a pendulum swing in the other direction. And it started in the mid-2000 or early 2010s, where there was, again, a recognition that everything was garbage. And in particular, it was a reaction to the fact that the manufacture of most things had been wholesale exported to China. And everything that arrived on your shores, because the American economy and the way that consumerism had evolved to its maybe lowest common denominator was that the only thing anyone cared about anymore was price. Price was the determiner of value. If you couldn't get it for cheaper, you always bought the cheaper thing. You bought the cheapest airplane ticket. You bought the cheapest polo shirt. Because it was a race to the bottom. And in China, you could, if you rolled your slave labor dice the right way, you could make a polo shirt that you could sell for a dollar. And that included shipping. And that was
What's interesting is I think in many cases, it doesn't matter how many of them are actually good.
Right.
Like you can deal with such a huge array of just garbage products because it costs 8 cents to manufacture. I was reading a memoir by somebody who went to, I think it wasn't even China. I think they were actually in North Korea from some Canadian animation studio using North Korean animation labor, and they're terrible at it.
Uh-huh.
So this guy would end up, he hated his job because he had to reject 85% of their product. But it didn't matter because it didn't matter if only 1 in 5 drawing was usable because they were getting paid less than a fifth what a
right.
North American animator would be paid.
It ended up penciling out.
So it didn't. Yeah. So they
except
don't,
it broke the soul of the people that had to
look at the bad work.
Right.
And it's the same way.
Who knows what it did to the souls of the people that were doing the bad work?
That's probably even worse.
But it became a kind of. It was a watchword of a certain kind of what seemed like thriftiness and good sense at a certain point in the 90s to recognize that this polo shirt cost $80 because it had a horsey on it, and this polo shirt cost $20 because it was from The Gap.
You're a better mom if you go to Old Navy.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that race to the bottom where everything was suddenly on sale, everything. I mean, if you think about the largest stores in the country, they're all discount stores now.
Mm-hmm.
Target and Marshall's and all these things, they start as like, you don't have to pay full price.
It really ties into our desire to want a new thing. Like if that's how you heal your soul in a consumerist economy is buying things, then you're going to need something new. It doesn't matter if the polo shirt lasts 8 years or
eight months.
If it only lasts 8 months, great. You get the fun of buying a new one next August.
And that disposable culture produces a situation where you do get a new pair of shoes every month or every 6 months.
How fun is that?
Not because you wanted them, because you need them. And that idea that like, well, I need these shoes, so I get to go to the store and buy these flashy and ornate and vulgar.
And for someone like me who does not think shopping is fun, it really is frustration when the thing wears out and you're trying to find the same thing or the closest thing to it because you don't want the hassle of trying to figure out what the new flashy thing is. You just wish your other thing hadn't fallen apart.
Well, what happened in the 2010s was, a movement kind of driven by the millennials to suddenly rediscover, what were described as heritage brands. And that was a component of not a not a return to nature or back to nature movement so much as a simplification of our lives movement, a preference for bicycles, a preference for clothes that were made in America that would last, a pair of shoes that...
That's our idea of nature.
Right.
A
pair of shoes that would last two to five years.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, you know, mocked or derided as the artisanal movement. You know, it extended all the way across the spectrum. People started to want farm fresh eggs. They wanted to have chickens of their own. There were people going into beekeeping who lived in the city. You know, there were people who were returning to practicing crafts, blacksmiths and glass blowers as a way of finding meaning in a contemporary world. And one that we were well past the point that even before this social media debacle of the last 5 years, well past the point where computers and mass production had divorced us almost completely from a connection to basic needs.
I've kind of been teasing my son lately because all of his hobbies now are between 500 and 800 years old. He's getting really into chess, and he will play online, but he's getting into chess.
Right.
He and his friends were out, they walk the railroad tracks trying to find old spikes that they can then smelt into things. They're doing backyard blacksmithery.
Whoa.
Is that the word? What's the noun of blacksmithery?
So,
you know, whatever this return to nature is, it is like reached into high schools in 2020.
Well, what happened, I think, to the millennial version of it was that it very quickly became a kind of connoisseur culture where if you want to buy a pair of shoes made in America that are going to last for 10 years, they cost $400.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of, again, philosophy, theory behind it, that if you bought a pair of shoes every year for 10 years, it was going to cost you way more than $400. So your $400 investment, although it seems crazy, is actually money well spent.
But even that is a kind of privilege because you got to have the money up front.
You
got
to have the money. And you have to be, and also the shoes that cost $400, you know, a lot of them are work boots mm-hmm. and work clothes that have been recaptured. You know, those companies like Shinola or Levi's or Filson or Pendleton, you know, they've been making these products for a century and a half, but now they're being marketed in a very crafty way, as American made. And a lot of times, you know, they're American assembled from products made in China or from components made in China. But that was a very expensive and connoisseur based culture, that was easily mocked. There were a lot of people that were buying $400 axes to just hang in their living room. The idea that they would ever use that axe for anything, but it was a beautiful thing, an item, a talisman to replace what would have been money spent on video game cartridges or a Nagel print.
I guess now there's so much information out there. You can find out what the right thing is to own without actually having any firsthand experience or expertise.
Right. And there are a thousand blogs that will tell you what the best handmade brass compass is mm-hmm. if you want to take your three-masted frigate out to Brigadoon. but that, in the social media age, and I'm talking that was a movement, the artisanal crafts movement was...
Don't say artisanal.
Was one... that was kind of popular as the millennium generation matured, right? They were now first becoming prosperous, had disposable income, maybe weren't able to afford their own home, but they could certainly buy an $800 axe. It was an expression of having arrived for a generation newly in their 30s. But the hangover from it was that as social media and as the American political scene sort of descended into chaos, there was a fascistic quality to it, because it, you know, the idea of it being made in America is nationalistic, and the idea of a lot of this stuff being back to the land is now connected to a kind of post-apocalyptic expectation.
Oh, interesting. Right? Like, I'm going to have this axe for when, for prepper reasons?
Yeah, I have it now in my apartment, and I won't need it, but I will need it when the race war happens. And so that those associations and the combination of this sort of initially an everyday carry culture is one that is almost kind of Walden-esque. It's very easy to watch
it's the dark side of Walden.
Turn dark, right. But now, Generation Z, what are we calling them? The Zeds?
Zoomers?
The Zoomers.
People do say Zoomers, which is kind of funny. It's like they're faster baby boomers.
Yeah, the Zoomers are now coming of age, and you're watching it happen in your own house, but we're seeing Zoomers who have been raised entirely in a social media environment. And I first noticed it with the arrival of Snapchat, which shocked me and offended me that the premise of Snapchat was that there was no archive.
Yeah.
And this was true of the early days of 4chan. The idea that you would put any effort into a thing and have no record of it. For those of us that grew up with photo albums and and your journals, the idea that you would take pictures and have them disappear.
Yeah, it's the ultimate negation of any kind of artisanal craftsmanship, because you end with nothing.
And for us as Generation X, it was astonishing to me to go on Snapchat and realize, oh, the point of this is not that you are making anything. This is just a place to be. They don't have anywhere to be. And they can just be here, and there's nothing to haunt them. There's nobody's, you can't take this and put it in their face later. And as the Zoomers they're very young still, you know, they don't have the money to buy an $800 axe, but they want a more meaningful life, a life that isn't just transacted on Instagram, that isn't entirely put out into the panopticon of a life online.
Yeah, I feel like they're as aware, if not more, than we are of the limitations of the screen-based life. They don't seem able to escape from it. But they don't like it.
Well, and
I guess the escape can be virtual. Is that what you're going to say?
No, the escape now. So in very recent years, only the last couple of years, there was a kind of noticeable uptick in and on social media and Instagram and other places, a sort of world like my daughter's, where all of a sudden gingham dresses and Instagram posts of young people outdoors interacting with nature, but also in a kind of pre-industrial social way, barn dances and kind of like real retro.
And are these real life occurrences happening? Or I thought a lot of this was kind of mediated through fan art and carefully chosen still photos.
It was
before the pandemic. Some of this was actually happening.
It was happening, but of course this generation is like a lot of generations that kind of develop a back to nature mentality. They're just one generation away from anyone that knows actually anything about square dancing firsthand, right? Or anything about, I mean, these are, they're rediscovering old, not just technologies, but old moral technologies, which is to say that to put your hands on a thing, to touch wood, if you will, is life affirming, and also the the contradiction in terms is that the only way we know about this is that it's happening on social media, which is the opposite of this unmediated experience.
So what are the hallmarks of this aesthetic, this new cottagecore?
So cottagecore is just what it sounds like, and the aesthetic isn't particularly, the aesthetic doesn't have any elements that you would look at and say, I've never seen it before. You know, the aesthetic is just,
it's the opposite, right? It's purposeful nostalgia.
It's just your chickens and your pinafores and your,
so it's a kind of an unspecific rural life,
right?
Without too many details about who's farming and why. But it's, if stuff's old timey, if people are putting away watermelon rind preserves and feeding the chickens, that's good.
It's an attempt to find meaning. But what differentiates it is that it's become a LGBTQ safe place. That
is, cottagecore is largely a lesbian aesthetic?
Not largely, but it has been, it has become a component of a kind of lesbian driven movement, but also people throughout the queer spectrum, because the one thing that Little House on the Prairie and Pioneer Town and Colonial Williamsburg and all these past movements to a pastoral existence, the one thing none of them had was a safe place,
queer visibility
for queer,
yeah,
and so, or for queer culture, yeah, of any kind. I mean, the traditionalism of them, and because you still see, I mean, you see in Southern Utah people in these same gingham dresses and bonnets who are trying to, or in, you know, Western Pennsylvania, who are still trying to live according to that premise, that connection to the land, without any 20th century mediation. But that return, but from a Zoomer perspective, as a way of saying, these were things that we've never in literature or in any consumption of media throughout our lives,
yeah,
have ever been able to place ourselves within.
It's essentially, it's an alternate history, right?
Right.
Like, what if there were, you know, little flannel-wearing lesbian kids running around Little House in the Big Woods.
Yeah, we're going back to the 18th century because, and you can see it because post-queer liberation, all those aesthetics that were part of the liberation movements are all modern. They're all postmodern. A lot of the philosophy underpinning those movements are postmodern philosophies.
Certainly the visual aesthetic is often forward looking.
Very forward. It's, you know, and even the rainbow flag, even piercings, tattoos. I mean, these are all, like ways of signaling, but ways of signaling that aesthetic doesn't appeal to everyone.
A lot of those say, you know, we're more advanced. This is the next thing.
Right.
We're the cutting edge of, you know, straight fashion is going to land here in 10 years. We're there already.
But to say,
and this is the opposite.
You know, I'm queer, but what I want is a simple life and to be in touch with nature and good food and a connection to making things like a connection to that, the affection that one might have for just the process of.
Maybe this is just because existence. I see it filtered through social medias, but like the symptoms I see of a lot of this are people, I don't see a lot of the yearning for the actual life as much as I do people enjoying the quaint visuals.
And what we'll see, I think, because we're in the very earliest days and the quarantine has really accentuated this, and I've read some kind of theorization that because the quarantine in its initial days said very explicitly, like, don't go outside, mm-hmm, that this conspicuous outside iconography, you know, to be out in a field and to be dancing under the moonlight, that this was really just another sort of act of youthful rebellion. It's just, and it's been true many, many times throughout the last two or three centuries, that a return to nature is a act of rebellion against the against the dominant.
Sure, they can't. They can't.
Class.
They can't get you in the forest. That's the whole Bruno Bettelheim thing about the woods. Like the social strictures can't touch you there.
And what we don't know yet is how much the proliferation of this ideology throughout social media will result in what we've been hoping for on the Omnibus the whole time, a wholesale rejection of social media. We'll never know.
Yeah. If social media goes away, how will people get their cottage core pictures to each other? I guess they'll just invite each other to their cottages.
You and I are sitting here on Instagram waiting to learn more about cottage core.
I want to see a picture of a loom. Where do they all go?
And they're out there potentially, right?
They're out there weaving.
It's the natural extension of it that what we'll learn is that, that some large number of Zoomers have departed for Vashon Island.
We'll find out later when they make us a sampler about it. And that concludes Cottage Core, entry 283.ZP0206, certificate number 45989, in the Omnibus. Now, those of us who are left behind, we're kind of the, when the rapture happens and all the Cottage Core people go into the woods, John and I will probably still be left on social media as at John Roderick, at Ken Jennings, at Omnibus Project. As always, feel free to follow us there. If you have something you want to say, you can do so at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to send us your physical items, your quilts and your foraged mushrooms and your the recordings of your mandolin music, please send us all your best cottagecore products to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. This is like the perfect stuff for a cottagecore show. Did you see what, it was Rick who sent us the Indiana skiing poster?
Yes.
Now he's also, I think his day job appears to be in beekeeping because he sent us some honey.
Oh my goodness, look at those. And they're two very different honeys, a dark and a light.
Well, here's why. One's from the 2017 collection, one's from 2020.
Oh, these bees were sucking on different flowers.
Yeah, what was happening in 2017? It was early Trump era. The bees are all depressed.
A much darker and more amber honey.
Or do you think it just ages? Do you think 2020s will look like this in 3 years?
I don't. Think so.
I don't know. Every hive counts. He tells us and sent us some stickers. So you and I have to decide which of us wants the new honey and which of us wants
the new honey.
Which of us wants
wants the old honey?
Call me maybe era 2017 honey.
I will take either honey because I believe in this honey.
You believe in this honey?
I believe in it. I believe either honey is going to be great.
I've said I have an herb garden, and you've said you don't like herbs, but I think about this all the time because the bees love whatever's in blossom.
Yeah.
And we currently have a lot of bees buzzing our oregano, and I'm just thinking about the awful honey they're going to make that tastes like oregano.
Oregano honey.
I know it.
Yeah. Mm.
So I apologize to any beekeepers in our area who are going to get Domino's pizza tasting honey thanks to us. Thank you, Rick, for sending us that. We also got a postcard from Kathy from Donner Summit.
Oh, well.
Look at that.
Well.
Donner Summit Bridge, overlooking Donner Lake. Beautiful.
Look at that. That's wonderful. That makes me want to eat my friend's wife.
Well, you don't have to go to the Continental Divide for that, John. This is modern Seattle.
That's true. I could eat my friend's wife anytime.
No, the 10th commandment says, please do not. I just want to watch Jerry Falwell Jr. eat his friend's wife.
Right. Roof. Jerry Falwell Jr. watch me eat his friend's wife.
That's what he'd be more into. Yeah. You can find fellow futurelings online. You can all share your cottagecore interests at the Futurelings Facebook group or subreddit or Discord. You are one of the, if your cottagecore aesthetic is being funded by your status as some kind of economic elite with disposable income to burn, show your support for some of the last remaining craftspeople, podcasters, hewing a beautiful tapestry, weaving, I guess you don't hew a tapestry, weaving a beautiful tapestry from the...
Hew it.
From the thinnest of threads, Hugh Hewitt?
No.
From the thinnest of threads, Jennifer Love Hewitt?
Hmm.
As we do weekly on Omnibus, twice a week on Omnibus, you can make a financial contribution and become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/omnibusproject. And we thank you if you do.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We wouldn't even know if it stopped surviving, because we'd be watching Instagram and we'd be in the dark.
Only you will know. We'd literally be in the dark.
You, futurelings, will know because your historical record presumably will be able to...
You know exactly how many weeks we have left, and you're laughing it up.
You may feel like, oh, it already started, and you dummies don't even know.
You guys are going to be foraging mushrooms before you know it, and not by choice.
We hope and pray that catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.